Thank you, Jim. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic.
All right, buddy.
You know, I don't take any notes. I paid the price of getting here. I heard a lot of people say don't prepare. I prepared 27 years to get here tonight. It cost me my dignity and my self-respect and everything I ever loved and ever hoped for to get here tonight. You know, so, and they say there's no dues or fees in AA. That's no financial dues or fees. Before I start, there's a Jim H. was told a Japanese joke, and I'd like to share it with you tonight. Is that all right? The guy was half Japanese and half Jewish. You hear about him? Every December 7th, it attacked Pearl Schwartz. That's not the one he told me, though. He got nervous, see. He's worried about it. He's a little worried. Don't worry about it. He told me the one about Kim Harrell. You know, this is I'm grateful I'm here tonight. 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and I couldn't even talk. I had to whisper in the doctor's ear and tell him that I had to speak at Mount Eagle, Tennessee, and I wondered if I could make it tonight. I had an abscess on my throat. You know, he gave me a big injection of penicillin and some antibiotics, and you know, I must have been supposed to be here tonight because I can talk. Now, I told somebody at work I can't talk, and he started smiling. That's the best news I heard in a long time. Might have some peace around here. I haven't had any alcohol or mood changing drugs since January 10th, 1972. I share that because of my sponsor today, and my sponsors in my community program of Alcoholics Anonymous told me if you don't have a sobriety date, you haven't had your last drink. The other reason is to prove to you that it works. And the other thing I'll share with you tonight is that the only reason I'm standing here sober tonight is because I couldn't stay drunk. If it was up to me, I'd still be out there drinking. If I'd have had my way, I'd still be out there drinking. The only reason that I'm standing here sober tonight is because every time I pick up a drink of alcohol or started swallowing something of a chemical nature, there came a time in my life when I had to get sober. Either I was tied down to a cot in a jail or in a nut house somewhere, or somebody was standing over top of me in a detox somewhere telling me I had to get sober. My problems didn't start the first day I started drinking. My problems really started the first time somebody told me I had to stop drinking. That's when my problems started. Because you see, alcohol was the only thing I ever found in my life that put me back together again. Alcohol was the only thing for a long, long time that never lied to me. It did the same thing for me the next time I drank it as it did for me the last time I drank it. And I never forgot, and I still haven't forgot, the one thing that I learned the first time I picked up a drink of alcohol, that booze worked. It did everything for me that all the going to church and listening to all the authorities in the world ever did for me. It made me feel good. And it was a solution to my problems. And if alcohol wouldn't have gave me any problems, I'd still be out there drinking. No, so that's the only reason I got sober, because the solution of my problems became a problem. And I was given a gift of this program and by you people of having that understanding and helped me to realize that alcohol, the very thing that was a solution to my problem, became the problem. Not many of us alcoholics have that privilege. Most of us go to their grave with the illness knowing nothing about the understanding that the solution has become the problem. And I'm grateful tonight to be standing here knowing that there's two ways to go for somebody like me. When I got up this morning, I don't know, I was feeling kind of bad, and I was skimming through my high school yearbook and just going back, and I really started getting, I don't know, melancholy, if you will. And I really got emotional because I was reading some of the things that those kids were talking about in that yearbook with me. And if I will, I'm going to share a couple things with you about what they were talking about. Jim, a real friend, I hope you can stop after Wednesday. Jim, best wishes to a great kid that drinks enough for him and me both. And this is the one that really got me. Jim, to a real swinging kid who ought to stay sober, but instead, well, let's forget it. Best of luck. Best wishes, Stan. I was 18, 19 years old when these kids wrote that. And it was back then there in my high school, year that these kids have already given up on me. And I always started making those promises, you know, that after Wednesday, after graduation, I was going to stop drinking. And these kids were all pulling for me. And they all wanted me to stop because they knew that I had, they knew the kind of person I was when I didn't drink, and they knew what the booze was doing to me already. And a couple of these, one of these kids that wrote something in this committed suicide, and he died an alcoholic death himself. And, you know, I think this about sums up, you know, because a lot of times, some of the things I heard when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 20 years old, and after that, you know, was that, you know, you hadn't drank enough, you know, or, yeah, I spilled more than, you know, you ever drank, you know. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 20, I'd been committed to a state mental hospital, and I had drank up a lot of things at that time. When I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1965, I sat out during a meeting such as this, and I heard a speaker stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked about losing all the things I had. He talked about losing the love and understanding of his family. He talked about losing his job and losing his wife and losing all the things that he ever loved or ever hoped for. I heard that speaker talk about ending up on Skid Row that night. And he shared those things that night. And after that meeting was over, there was a man who came up and he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "Son, there's some guarantees in this deal." He said, "If you continue to come to these meetings and stay sober," he said, "I'll guarantee you that your life will continually get better." But he said, "There's also another guarantee." He said, "If you continue to drink," he said, "you may end up losing all the things that like that man had lost. You may end up living on Skid Row, getting divorced and all those things." And I thought to myself at that time, "Mister, you don't understand what kind of a guy I am. You don't understand how much pride I got. You don't understand that that man was a fool for going through all the things he went through. If I even got divorced from my first wife, or if I even got divorced, I'd kill myself. I love my wife. You don't understand about my family. Nobody ever got put out of my family. You know, rehabilitation for an alcoholic in my family set in 3 days after rigor mortis set in." I haven't come from a typical alcoholic family. I'm not an alcoholic who comes from a typical family. All my people were drunks. You know, I didn't come from a Christian upbringing. You know, we owned a bar. I social drank from the time I was 5 years old to I was 11, and I quit. I had 4 years of sobriety by the time I was 15 years old. I stopped on willpower too. I was 11 years old, and I stood at my father's grave. 2 months before that, the doctor had told my dad, "If you don't stop drinking, you're going to die." My dad went back to drinking, and he died. He was 35 years old. I stood at my father's grave that day, and I didn't have the gift of tears that God gives every little 11-year-old boy who lost his father. I couldn't cry because I knew that he knew that if he drank, he'd die, and I wondered why he did that. I stood there with the shame and loneliness of a lifetime inside my guts. And I couldn't cry, but I made one vow that day, when I grow up, I'll not ever be like you. I'm never going to cause anybody the shame and humiliation that I felt that day. And I did for the next 4 years. I went about studying religion and studying the Bible, and I built my spiritual foundation on that hatred. And it don't work. And I started drinking when I was 15 years old at a youth center dance one night. And they were passing around a bottle of wine. And the first two times it went around me, I let it go. And the third time it came around me, I took a drink out of it. And that was it. And in the doctor's opinion of the big book that talks about having a psychic change the other way, I had a psychic change that night toward alcohol. You know, I went from a hatred from a substance. From that night on, I never had enough. I never drank alcohol for what that might do to me. I drank alcohol for what it did for me. I never had enough. I didn't drink daily that night on, but every time I drank, I got drunk from that point of my life on. From that point of my life on, my whole life was just fixed around drinking. I went from a B and C student to a D. I went from a person who liked athletes to sitting in the grandstand pretending that I could have been the best football player on the team, but I never had to play anymore. I couldn't play. The fear started, and everything started. I got committed when I was 19. I went to my first AA meeting that night when I was 20. You know, I had already had enough at the age of 20. And as you heard me share some of the things these kids wrote about, I had had enough. I thought I had enough. When I stood in that meeting that night, I thought, you know, I had no earthly idea what an alcoholic was. I stood there that night, and I guess the thing I thought the most was, an alcoholic's like my old man, and I'm not that bad yet. I'll never be that bad. Because I hadn't lost the things that I thought was necessary not to be an alcoholic. For the next 7 years, I went out to prove exactly what that man had said was true. For the next 7 years, I drank up everything I ever loved or ever hoped for. I went through divorces and everything else. I like the story that Tom shared up here, the boy whose mother caught him in the bathroom messing around with himself. And he sits down and she sits down and she gives him this doomsday story about what happens to little boys that do these things. And finally she tells him, if you keep doing it, you're going to go blind. And he looks up at her and he says, well, is it all right if I do it just until I have to wear glasses? And that sums up my alcoholism. You know, I was going to stop drinking right before my first wife walked out the door. I love my first wife. But before I stopped drinking, I'd been divorced twice. I was going to stop drinking right before I lost my job. I had a lifetime job guaranteed to me in that company. Before I stopped drinking, I hadn't worked in over 3 years. I was going to stop drinking right before I lost the love and understanding of my family. Before I stopped drinking, my family had put me out. My mother put me up for adoption. I was 27 years old when she did it. Saved my life. I was going to stop drinking right before I lost my dignity and my self-respect. But before I stopped drinking, I had to beg. And I had to beg my brother-in-law, me and him loafed around and fought together and loved each other. And I used to have to get down on my hands and knees and run and didn't have enough money to go to work with. He'd give me $2 and he'd say, Jim, please don't ask me tomorrow. And he said, I just don't have it. And he said, you'll get it off me if you beg, but please don't be this way with me. He said, it makes me sick. And I'd promise him, just give me $2 today and I won't do it again tomorrow. And the next morning I need a drink and it was back to the same stuff. And I knew that kid would give it to me. And I'd get down on my hands and knees and I'd cry, do he give me enough money to get a drink? And I'd see him throw that dollar bill at me and walk out the door in disgust. I believe that this is exactly what my alcoholism did for me. I remember one night that guy got out of come down over the hill and I was sleeping in his car. I remember he got in the car and he started the engine up and I had been sleeping on the front seat of the car and the beer in the front seat of the car that I was drinking had froze. And he was going down the road and he used to take me down the road and drop me off at the bar in the morning. He was hollering at me for not starting his automobile. And I wouldn't start his automobile and run the gas out because I needed that money to drink on. We manage. Alcoholics manage. You know, I thought I was being gracious to him, but I wasn't starting his automobile not to run the gas out. I knew that I wanted to save that so he could give me enough money to get started with a drink. But I remember going down the road this particular morning and I was shaking and I was scared and I looked at him, you know, and I said, I was cold, you know, and I said to him, you know, Ron, I wish I was dead. And that kid looked back at me that morning and he had tears in his eyes and he said, you know, Jim, I wish you was dead too. He said, if they wouldn't do anything to me, he said, I'd come down over the hill and I'd put a bullet in your head with my 30-30 and get you out of your misery. He said, I know you don't want to be drunk, but he said, I know you can't be sober. We've taken you off to every nut house, every detox, every rehabilitation center in the state of Pennsylvania and evidently you can't get sober. This kid really, you know, and he loved me, and it was almost, you know, that thing inside of me said, you know, what are you doing to these people? What are you doing to these people? And I had to get away from these people because I knew I was going to be a mercy killer. I didn't know whether I was being a hero or being a coward. But that's the way these people started feeling about me. I couldn't stand that anymore. You know, so I continued to drink, and I continued to do the things I did. And I wound up, in 1971, I wound up in a... My mother hunted me down in 1971, right after Gloria and I got divorced. And this was in March of 1971. My mom found me, and she said, "Jimmy," she said, "turn yourself in. They're going to find you, and they're going to arrest you anyways. And if you go in there with me, maybe perhaps they won't put you in jail." And I made my mother promise me that they wouldn't put me in jail. I made her promise me. And she said she wouldn't let. She told me that. And on the way into the town, I stayed sober for 12 hours before I went in there. But on the way into the town, I couldn't face those people. I had to face a psychiatrist of the court that morning, a probation officer, and a psychologist of the courts. And my freedom meant me going before those people and be sober. But I couldn't go before those people and be sober. I had to have my mother stop not once, but maybe four or five times, different stops on the way in there to get me a couple of double headers of vodka so they wouldn't smell it. My God, it was coming out of my pores by that time. It was like rubbing out. By the time I got in there to face those people, I was dead drunk. And I swore, and I went in there to talk to those people, and my mother standing beside me, and I swore to God that I hadn't had a drink that day, and my mother said, he's absolutely right. She swore on her mother's grave, and I swore on my father's grave that I hadn't had a drink, and my mom's backing me up all the way, you know, and out of the door they'd have a conference, and out of the door I'd go. I'd leave that seventh floor of that building, I'd go, and outside the street I'd have a couple more double headers of vodka and back up to face those people again. And finally they gave me a choice. The choice was to sign commitment papers to the Danville State Mental Institution for a year and a day, or serve out the remainder of my probation in the county prison of Pittsburgh. And being of sound alcoholic mind, I chose the county prison of Pittsburgh. I wasn't going back to any more of their finer laughing academies anymore. You know, I was sick and tired of building up my hopes and dreams and aspirations about 9 foot off the ground, only to find myself back in the same damn gutters I come out of. But the thing that was so amazing about that day, when those people, when they knew I was drunk and I knew I was drunk, when those people come up there and they put those handcuffs on me and put that straitjacket around me, I turned and looked my mother dead in the eye, and I said, "Look what you've done to me now." I could not take the responsibility for what I had done in my life. The last picture I seen of my mother was her collapsing on the floor. She had emphysema and she has a bad heart, and it could have killed her. She didn't want to see me being taken to jail. 3 days later, I woke up in the infirmary of the county jail. I'd gone into DTs. It was the second time I'd been in DTs. And I woke up in the infirmary of that county jail, and I was tied down to a cot with a hole underneath my rear end and a horse bucket beside me, and I was dying. I knew I was dying. But I made a vow that day when I woke up that I was going to get away from these people that cared enough about me to put me in prison and do anything they could to stop me from drinking. I was going to get away from these people so I could drink and do what I wanted to out of life. If I ever got out of that jail, I was going to get just leave these people. And that's what I did when I got out of there. I went to Philadelphia, and I wound up in Skid Row out there, and I stayed out there for about 8 months, and I come back to Pittsburgh. And I wound up in a flop pot over in the north side of Pittsburgh. January 7th, I called my other sister's house, and Tommy answered the phone, my other brother-in-law. And the first thing Tommy said to me is, "Why don't you kill yourself?" Now, these people were really being serious. You know, one time I used to tell these people, "I'm going to kill myself," and they put me in a nut house. Now they were asking me to. I said to them, I said, "What the hell have I done to you now?" I said, "I've been away from you people for almost a year. I haven't bothered you. I mean, give me a break. You know, I've let you alone." He said, "Your sister has found out you're in town, Jim. She's over there running through all those flop houses over there trying to find you. She's nuts. We've got two little babies here that need taking care of." He said, "You're not worth it anymore." So I told him where I was, and he brought her over. And it was about, I don't know what time of night it was, but she came through the door of that flop house with a bowl of spaghetti and a tossed salad and silverware, napkins, the whole works. It was unbelievable. My family had one thing: feed him and he'll get back to health. You know, they tried it, the bitter end. I'm sitting in this flop house. I hadn't had a bath in 6 months. You know, I had the mattress up against the wall. I had urinated it so many times. I'm sleeping on the springs. And here's my sister. She's going to feed me. She sets this spaghetti down in front of me, and it's tossed salad and all the silver, and it works. And the only thing I could think of in my sick mind at that time was to drive that girl away from me. So I started eating the spaghetti with my hands and screaming every obscenity I'd ever learned in my life. Just continued to rave on like a maniac. Not like a maniac. God, I was one. And finally, when I had exhausted myself, I looked at her, and she was still standing there. It was just the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. I kind of looked at her and was questioning why she was still there. She was a born-again Christian. I had just laced her God and everything she had stood for down the drain. She looked me dead in the eye. And she said this to me, "You're my brother and I love you. If you walk out of this flop house tonight, if you get sober, if you get married and become one of the most decent husbands that ever walked the face of this earth, and get saved and stay sober for the rest of your life and have children and become the greatest father that ever fathered children." She said, "I won't love you any more than I do right now tonight." She said, "On the other hand, if you choose to continue to drink and to decay here as a human being, never draw another sober breath for as long as you live and continue to hurt yourself and others," she said, I won't love you any less than I do right now." She said, "Jimmy, you're my brother, and I want for you what you want out of life. And if this is what you want, so be it." 2.5 years ago, my sister came down to visit me, and she finished the story for me, because I didn't know the whole thing. She said when she went to the door of the flop house, she threw a dime at me, and she said, "If you want to get sober, call me. But I'm not coming back here to visit you. I'd rather be coming to your funeral." She left. There was no way in God's world that I could have understood that message that night. As a matter of fact, I was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous some 3 or 4 months when I heard a speaker talk about almost the exact same thing at a retreat in Cook's Falls. And then it began to become very clear of what I had found in this program. But that night, I was too sick-minded to know what message was given. But that message was a message of unconditional love from one human being to another. It's the unconditional love that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous has for any alcoholic or any human being. It's not a book about condemning alcohol or condemning this or condemning that. It's a book about a way of life if a person wants it. And it's there for the asking if a person applies himself to it. But there was no way that night I could have figured that out. I drank a half a pint of whiskey, woke up 3 days later, and I called my sister. And she got me back into St. Francis Hospital for the 13th time. And that, the thing about it, that morning when I woke up, January 10th, 1972, I knew it was over. I didn't know what was over, but I knew it was over. But the thing that I realized probably more then than I ever again realized in my life, that I realized how damn hard I had worked to get to the bottom of my life. Being an alcoholic was the hardest thing I ever done in my life. Staying drunk was the hardest thing I ever done in my life. Because once again, I was put in another position where now I had to get sober. And I didn't want to, but by God, I thought, I got to get sober again. And I got to go through this, all this crap. And I realized another thing that was probably just as important, that I was responsible for being in that flop house on Skid Row. It wasn't my father's fault. It wasn't my stepdad's fault. It wasn't my wife's fault or my psychiatrist's fault or anybody else's fault. It was my responsibility for being in that flop house on Skid Row. And I love what it says in the book, Big Book, because I think that rang true to me as anything else. It says, the wrongdoings of others, fancy or real, have the power to actually kill us. As long as I felt that they were responsible for putting me there, then by God, the wrongdoings of their own wrongdoings, fancy or real, had the power to kill me. But when I took the responsibility of my addiction, when I realized that I was responsible for being in that flop house on Skid Row, then by God, I could be responsible for my recovery. And I walked out of that place that morning, and I didn't know where I was going. I thought I'd gone completely berserk, because I felt a peace of mind and serenity that I hadn't felt in a long time. I didn't know where I was going. I went back to face the same psychiatrist to try to commit me to Danville. And I walked into his office, and I said, "I'm ready to go." And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to Danville. And I'm not going to Danville for a year and a day. I'm going to Danville for the rest of my life." He said, what's wrong with you now? I said, I got to get away from that crazy sister of mine. You know, just commit me. I said, she's going nuts. That doctor looked at me that morning. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, let me tell you something. You're not going to Danville. You're not going to Eagleville. You're not going to Mayview or Woodville. You're not going to St. John's or Gateway. And you're not coming back to this hospital anymore. There's only one place left for somebody like you. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, they've given up on me. I really did. I thought, that's it. You know, they're throwing me with dogs now, you know. I mean, you know, I used to, you know how people drop names? I used to drop names of psychiatrists, you know. You know, I needed this guy, man. I got biggie problems, you know. And he says, you'll be in this hospital 3 to 5 days, and that's it. No medication, no nothing. He told me another thing that's probably just as invaluable to me as anything else I've ever learned in my life. He said another thing. He said, you're not going to kill yourself in your addiction. He said, 12 other times you've been in this hospital, you have cirrhosis of the liver, you've got kidneys that are malfunctioning, you've got ulcers. I've told you you're going to die if you drink again. He said, clowns like you probably won't die. He said, you'll probably live on Skid Row till you're 80 years old. And that terrified me. That actually terrified me. Because I believed the man was right. You know, it's just like I felt yesterday. I wasn't afraid that I was going to die yesterday. I was afraid I might not die. That's the way I felt in my addiction. You know, I thought when I was on Skid Row, Philadelphia, that I had done died and went to hell. And I mean that. Boy, that's a haunting feeling. Because when people are telling you you're going to die if you drink again, you go back to drinking, somewhere along the line, you got to get that feeling that what is hell. And I really believe that that's what the big book talks about, the living hell that we get into. We don't know what's going on. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful to those people. They put me back in that little cubbyhole back there, you know, and I started yelling and screaming. This little nurse come running back there, and she said, Mr. Swagger, what's wrong with you? And I said, I need some sleeping medication. She said, Mr. Swagger, you're not going to get any medication. I said, lady, you got to get me something. She said, Mr. Swagger, what's going to happen if you don't get any? I said, lady, I'll just tear this whole damn room apart. Starts kicking and screaming and just tear the whole damn place up. And I'll flip out. And she looked in there and she said, Mr. Slaughter, if you do flip out, please shut the door so you don't bother the other patients in this hospital. And she walked away. And that lady saved my life. I sat there and I knew. And I knew I'd been had. And that was the beginning of a set of circumstances, as we may call them, that led me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started staying sober in a flop house on Skid Row, and I started going to meetings. And I went to a lot of meetings. I got a sponsor. I never forget Nick, you know, and Nick and Alice, you know. I'll tell you, the things that those people did for me, Nick and Alice and Mary Lou, were just absolutely profound for me. I really, you know, it's just unbelievable what those people did in my life. I always reflect back and see that it couldn't. I don't know how it could have been any different for somebody. I went to Nick and I said, well, that's it. I quit drinking. He said, no, you don't have to quit drinking. I said, no, that's it. I quit. He said, no, you don't have to quit drinking. He said, you don't have to quit drinking. You don't have to quit your old friends. You don't have to quit going to bars. He said, what you have to start doing, you got to stay sober today. You got to go to a meeting today. And you got to find some new friends today. He said, do all that quitting tomorrow. Leave it go. Postpone all that stuff a day at a time for the rest of your life. He said, people like you can't quit. Just stay sober, go to meetings, and meet new people. He said, the drink, the friends, the bars will always be out there tomorrow. He said, do it a day at a time for the rest of your life, and maybe everything will be all right. And the other thing he told me was just as important. He said, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous isn't here to stop you from drinking if you want to drink. But he said, I'll guarantee you one thing. If you stick around me, and if you stay sober for about 90 days and go to meetings with me, if you do go back out and drink, you're not going to die ignorant of what's wrong with you. And that's what I'm here for. And I thought, my God, what's this guy all about? Every time I turned around, all my life, people were telling me I had to stop doing this, I had to quit doing this. And for the first time in my life, people were sharing with me and putting information out there only if I want it. They won't give me a bunch of do's and don'ts. They were just sharing their own experiences and sharing with me the information. I think that became very important. I was in the program, I'd say 4 or 5 months, and I heard a speaker talk at Cook's Forest. And this speaker stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talked to 500 people that night, but I swear he was talking to me. And this guy's name was Johnny, and he's from California. And this speaker said, you just don't have to live that way no more if you don't want to. He said, you just don't have to do it that way anymore if you don't want to. And I think that was another valuable tool that I learned in this program. And I sat there and I thought, my God, that's it. I do have a choice today. But if I work these, you know, if I just keep an open mind and I come to these meetings, it's my ball game today. It's nobody else's. You know, and I had, you know, and I continue to go to meetings. And there was a lot of guys in Alcoholics Anonymous that just had simple one-liners that helped save my life. I went to Joe C., and Joe died sober, 27 years of sobriety. I went to Joe one day, and I said, Joe, how's it work? And he said, son, you go get me a cup of coffee and come to the back of the room, and I'll tell you exactly how it works. And I went up there, and I got Joe a cup of coffee and went to the back of the room. And Joe was sitting back there, and he was still a little stunned, and I set his coffee down. I said, Joe, tell me how it works. And he said, Jim, I'm going to tell you exactly how it works. And I brought myself up and ready for this story. He said, it works just fine. It's fine. And there was another guy named Joe. He was from Aliquippa. He was a steel mill worker. And when Joe got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had a wet brain. He couldn't think. He couldn't function. He could hardly move. His sponsor took him to meetings. His sponsor just didn't take him to one meeting a day. He took him to 2 or 3 meetings a day because that's all he had to do. And finally, after about a year and a half of going to all these meetings, Joe finally came back to reality and started getting sober. So I walked into a meeting one day and I asked Joe, how do you get sober, Joe? And Joe looked at me and he says, you go to meetings after 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 meetings. And I just walked away from him. But that's how he got sober. That's how he got sober. The only thing he remembered was going to meetings. He didn't remember nothing else. He just remembered going to meetings. And all of a sudden, one day, he woke up and he was sober a year and a half. And his functioning come back. And he became a brilliant man of simplicity in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I met another gal in the program, and we talk about, you know, how we take these steps, you know. And I remember the most fantastic story I used to tell these psychiatrists. I was good at telling my story to psychiatrists, you know. Boy, I was great at doing that, you know. But every time I'd end the story, I mean, it got a little bit longer each time, but every time it was a story about disaster, you know. And finally I ended up telling them, you know, doctor, I'm crazy. And then doctors would look back at me and they'd say, no, son, you're not crazy. I used to think to myself, I wonder what the hell the these guys went to school. And Nick, when I came into the program, Nick had never taken any barbiturates, so he didn't understand that stuff. So he told me to go talk to Mary Lou. And Mary Lou was a nurse, and a gal who was a nurse took, God, she took a lot of pills. And she was a beautiful woman. But I met her at the downtown meeting one afternoon to discuss with Mary Lou my pill addiction. But first I had to tell her the story. And I told her the whole story. The same story I used to tell the psychiatrist about me not wanting to be like my dad, how I started drinking and how I couldn't stop and how I got married the first time, got divorced and got married the second time, how much I love my wife and all the institutions, all that stuff. And finally I said to her, you know, Mary Lou, I'm crazy. And she looked back at me and she said, you're goddamn right you're crazy, Jim. But at least today you can do something about it. And that was the second step. You know, that was a thing that I missed all my life. For the first time in my life, I knew that somebody else understood what was going on inside of me. I started to put the pieces together again. You know, another thing that she did was so fantastic. I called her up one day. Gloria and I got back together. And we were back together. And I was going to a lot of meetings, you know. And Gloria, woke up one day. And Gloria come in there. And she said to me, she said, when are you going to get a job? I called my sponsor up. I said, what the hell is wrong with this woman? You know, here I am, I'm staying settled in all these meetings. Now she's pressuring me into getting a job. He said, Jim, maybe you better get a job. I felt like if I wouldn't take any booze money, I'm just, you know, just sitting there doing the dishes in the laundry, and that was sufficient enough. You know, but the pressure was applied to me. So I was going to go out and get a big shot truck mechanic job. Well, I hadn't worked in over 3 years, and they didn't hire me. Maybe these people at this church took pity on me, and they gave me a job making $2 an hour mowing grass in their cemetery. And I started working at Monday at 8 o'clock in the morning, and at 10 o'clock I got fired. I told this retired bald-headed guy, he was trying to show me how to run a red tractor. And I'll just tell you, I gave him all my vocabulary. And that consisted of four-letter words, and that was all. I just gave him every one of them. And he fired me. And I took about 3 steps away from that man. I thought, my God, how am I going to go home and tell this woman and all these people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't even hold down a $2 an hour job? So I thought, I better take the 10th step. So I turned around, went back, and apologized to Harry. And he took pity on me and gave him my job back. I love them people, you know. But, you know, the thing about it is, you know, at least I was trying. But here I was, and I was stuck in these dilemmas in my life, you know, and wondering what was going on all the time. And finally things did start to work. And I forgot where I was in that story, but I just jump on here, I guess. But, you know, there were so many things that started falling into place for me. And I did go to a lot of meetings. And I tried the very hardest I could to work these steps. You know. I was sober 3 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was driving up the road with a sales manager. I was working for Prudential, for a life insurance company. And the obsession to drink come back and hit me again. And when this obsession hit me, you know, the fear hit me and this cold sweats hit me again. And I scared the living daylights out of this sales manager. He turned around in the middle of the road and he run me back to the office and said, "What's the matter, Jim?" And I was too embarrassed to tell him what was wrong. So I got back to the office and immediately I called my sponsor and I said, "Nick, I can't take it anymore." I said, "I'm going to go talk to a psychiatrist." And Nick says, "You've been sober long enough, do whatever you need to do." "Maybe it's your decision. You want to go talk to the doctor? Go talk to the doctor." I said, "I'm sorry, but I got to go talk to the doctor." And I goes in to see the doctor. I got in before that doctor that day, and I told him, I said, "Doctor, I'm tired. I said, I'm tired of going to all these damn AA meetings. I'm tired of fighting this obsession. I'm tired of having to fight for my sobriety day in and day out. And I can't stand the anxieties. I'm just sick and tired of going to all these meetings and trying to stay sober. I said, "Would you please help me? I said, please commit me. I can't make it out there in those streets anymore. I don't want to drink and I don't want to take any pills. But evidently I can't exist out there in this world the way I am." And that doctor looked at me that day. He said, "Jim, I'm going to tell you something. It was the same thing I told you 3 years ago. But this time I'm going to tell you something different." He said, "Go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. But this time trust that those principles will work even for somebody like you." He told me one other thing. He said, "You haven't got a damn thing to lose. What do you got to lose if you trust them? If you trust that those principles will work even for somebody like you." And I really believe that that day, at that time, I made a decision in my life. I really believe that what it says in the chapter we agnostics, that I had struggled for over 3 years. And I believe that book because that book tells me that to live, be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. And I believe for those 3 years that I had compiled enough hope in this program that despite all my anxieties and all my fears and all my depressions, that I was willing to take that chance and that risk of accepting the third step and sitting down and doing a written inventory and sharing with one human being the exact nature of my wrongs. And I had done oral inventories and I'd spread my fifth step all over Pittsburgh prior to that time. And God knows that was sufficient. But all of a sudden, the trust came into that play. And I really realized that I didn't have nothing to lose. And I took that third step. And I chose, you know, a day at a time to try to live life on a spiritual basis. You know, and that's when I went into my four-step inventory and wrote it down, and I shared in the basement of my sponsor's house the exact nature of my wrongs. And it was after I was sober 3.5 years that the obsession to drink left me. And another guy named John A. from California shared this with me at Cedar Glen, Texas. And it helped me understand this. And I was always ashamed of that because I thought I'd done it wrong. But I don't really believe I did it wrong. Because it was like John said, he believed that he had the obsession drink for 4.5 years after he got to this program. But he said that he believed that because he kept going to meetings and kept trying, that God had removed just enough of the fear, just enough of the anxiety, just enough of the obsession that he could just hang in there and stay sober for one day. And I believe that perhaps for me, that's the way it was too. I believe that when you, for me, with the messing around I did with this program for the first 7 or 8 years I was around it, the grace of God wasn't going to come easy. But that's just the way it happened. And I believe that it took what it took to get me where I am today. You know, the book tells me to share in a general way what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like today. And I like to share what I'm like today. Because if it wasn't for you people, you know, I have two beautiful children and I got a beautiful wife. If it wasn't for you people, I wouldn't have that wife and I wouldn't have those children. If those children were here, they wouldn't have a father to take care of them like I did. And I remember it was a few months ago that I was sitting out in the backyard of my house and my boy was playing with these real big white grub worms, which I was definitely afraid of. He gets in there and plays with them. He's 2 years old and he's a fool, I thought. You know? But that little kid was sitting there playing with those grub worms and he was having one hell of a time. And I sat there and I said to myself, you know, Jim, this is reality. You are really living. This is not a dream. That's your little boy and that's your family. And sobriety is not a dream. No. And it's hard to believe sometimes. You know, it's just like, I shared in a meeting one time my story, and a man came up after I was done giving my talk, and he said, you know, son, you give a good talk. He said, but I really don't believe you've been through all the crap you've been through. And I looked at that guy and I said, you know what, mister? I don't believe it either. That's why I got to keep coming back to these meetings. Because it's hard for me to believe that I lived. Almost did it shamelessly. It's hard for me to believe that. But it's because I come to these meetings and I continue to stay sober that I realize, you know, the gift that I've been given, if you will. You know, the thing that I probably hit hard on in the last 3 years of my life was the step 6 and 7. And it really came home to me about 3.5 years ago. And I really believe that this step came into my life at the proper time, you know. And I loved it. I was at a meeting Wednesday night. I went to talk to a guy I'm sponsoring, and another guy I'm sponsoring called me up on the phone right before the meeting and said, you know, Jim, my aunt passed away. Would you please lead the meeting? So what do you lead the meeting on? He said the 6th step. And I thought, God, and I just talked to this guy about the 6th step. And I really believe the essence of the 6th step, you know, where I think there's four fantastic paragraphs in this whole program that I really enjoy. The first two, where it starts, it says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. That sensation is so elusive that while we admit it's injurious, we cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To us, our alcoholic life is the only normal one. And that's in the doctor's opinion of the big book, and it goes on and follows up, and I believe that that's where the first step lies. And I really believe that was me. My alcoholic life was the only normal one. I didn't have any other alternatives to my life. The only solution to my problems was to drink alcohol. Later on, when they introduced me into the psychiatric unit at Mayview State Hospital, they gave me drugs, and drugs became a solution to my problem. And later on, as I entered the psychiatric routine, then therapy became a solution to my problem. You know, and let me say this. If alcohol wouldn't have become a problem, I'd have still been drinking. If drugs wouldn't have become a problem, I'd still be drugging. And therapy became a problem. Therapy became a problem when they stopped taking me back in a nut house. If they'd have continued to take me back in the nut house, I'd still be nut housing it. You know. But one day they came up and they said, you ain't coming back in a nut house anymore. They said, the treatment's over. Don't you understand? The treatment's over. I tell it to guys today. The treatment's over. They didn't want you. They sent you to us. They sent you to AA. You're not nuts anymore. You know, the psychiatrists are through with you. They run around his program thinking we're crazy, you know. They don't want us. If we were crazy, they'd have kept us. I can convince people. I threw a hell of a lot of time to convince myself that. Yeah. Try to tell people, you know, we're running around here worrying about flipping out, but it says we've got to flip back in. They worry about flipping out. We've got to get in before we're out. But then it came to the sixth step. And I really believe that the thing that took place with me in the sixth step, and where it says in there, in Bill's writings in the 12 and 12 on that, I'm really grateful for what he wrote in there. Where he says the desires, no matter how far we have progressed, desires will always be found, which will oppose the grace of God. And then those next two paragraphs in there are really tremendous, because when it gets down there to the bottom and it says, we who escape these extremes are apt to congratulate ourselves, yet can we? Hasn't it been self-interest, pure and simple, that enables most of us to escape these defects at these rock-bottom levels? I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't killed anybody, and I hadn't raped anybody. When I took the sixth step, I realized the only reason I didn't kill anybody, especially my stepfather, is because I didn't want to spend any time in prison over that SOB. And the only reason I didn't rape anybody is because I was afraid of what my mother might think. So that step leveled me out to say, well, you got all the way to go now. You don't have to worry about being anywhere. You're nowhere. You know? That's like the story. I don't know where this guy came. Jim King. He's passed away now. Jim played this tape for me when I was in Panama City about 6-7 years ago. And this guy said that there's this guy that took an overnight. He just joined Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and he took an overnight train ride, and he sober about 4 or 5 days. And it come time for him to go to sleep, and he got back to his sleeper car, and he got his pajamas on and got all undressed to go to bed, and he pulled the curtain of his sleeper car open. And he looked in there, and there's two beautiful women laying in there. He looked in there, and he said, ladies, I just joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm trying to get better, so one of you girls are going to have to get the hell out of here. So we just get better. You know, that's sad, but, you know. And, you know, I realize that. You know what untreated alcoholism I found out is? When I took that sixth and seventh step, I realized what untreated alcoholism is. It's anything that Jim's fixed. If I fixed it, it's untreated. If I can fix it, then I don't need the steps of God to take care of it. And that's why this program's here. I really believe that we have to put ourselves in a position. I have to put myself in a position to have God remove these obsessions. I was sitting in a meeting one day, and this little kid was sitting in there, and he said, you know, he said, I had the obsession to drink last night. And he said, I've heard Jim S. say that he had the obsession to drink for over three years. He said, it isn't going to be like that for me. And I thought, my God, if I'd have had anything to do with it, I'd have got rid of mine right away, too. You know, who the hell needs that thing hanging on to you? But it wasn't up to me. If it was up to me to get rid of the obsession, any of them, I'd have got rid of a lot of them a long time ago. But these obsessions are removed on God's terms, on His times, not on mine. And what I had to do is I had to get ready. And I had to become willing. Then God removes the obsessions on His terms and His time, not on mine. And that was really a freedom in that step. And I love the word freedom in this program, you know, because I think that's the very thing that's been given to me and to us here tonight. The freedom of a happy life. The freedom to choose. Not only to choose, today, you know, one of the things that I thought the day I got sober, and one of the things I thought even before I got sober, is if I ever got an opportunity, I just would like an opportunity to find out if there is another way to live for somebody. I felt very cheated the last year of my drinking. I really did. I thought I was going to die, and I thought I was never going to find out if there was another way to go. And now, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles that we've learned here, I found out that God works. And I believe that that's what the second step is. I think the steps are merely a way of life from the first step to the second step. That's what the steps, the rest of the steps do. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 are just a path from the first step to the second. The life of be doomed to an alcoholic death and the life of the spiritual basis, I believe that that's the alternative. And I found out through the application of these steps in this program that God really works. But lo and behold, I have never or will never forget that booze also works. You know, I know one thing. When I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, it's because I remember the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that's the way it was for a long, long time. But today, more than any other thing, when I'm restless, irritable, and discontented, It's because I remember the sense and ease and comfort which come at once by taking these steps. And I think that's the important thing. I think for a long time people tried to make me forget that booze didn't work. But alcohol saved my life time and time and time again. If it wasn't for booze, I don't think I'd ever made it as far as I did in life. I didn't have any other solutions to my problems. Alcohol was a solution. And I really believe what it talks about and how it works, that self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. That alcohol was just one of the things that was there to help support me along with all the other things. The therapies and the drugs and the other things. It supported me long enough that I was blessed and graced enough to stay alive and long enough that I could find God at the bottom of all this. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a vehicle to get us to find a higher power, a God of our understanding. And that's what I find through the application of these steps. Herbert Spencer says in the back of the Big Book that there's a principle which is the bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think the one thing you owe yourself is just to try to keep an open mind, an honest open mind, and a willingness to try to find out if there's another way to go. The one thing I did in these meetings for a long, long time, anything that anybody said, the least little thing that don't upset me, if you upset me, I'm going to fix you. I'm going to run out that door. I'll get drunk and get put in jail and get the police called on me, get my brain. I'll fix you. That's the way I was for a long time. You know, I was sensitive. Finally, booze worked hard enough on me that I sat here and I became open-minded. And I become willing to listen. And I listened to what you people had to say, and I didn't contempt it. Many, many times I went out that door and I investigated that bottle. And finally, there came a time in my life when I sat here and I started investigating what you people had to say. And that's really when my life began to work. I really feel the only thing different between the way of the bottle and the way of God. For the first 27 years of my life, I lived with total desperation. For the first 27 years of my life, no matter how good things got, I knew eventually it was going to get worse. I knew I was going to louse it up somehow. In the past 10.5 years, I've lived with one other concept in mind. No matter how good or bad things have gotten, I've always lived with the hope that things are going to be better. That things are going to be better. There's two things that I haven't failed to do since I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The one is I haven't had a drink or taken anything of the chemical nature. And the other thing is that I get on my knees each morning and ask for help. And I get on my knees and thank God each night for another day of surprise. And every time and every night, it hasn't failed, no matter how good or bad things are going, when I get on my knees and say thank you, God, that I don't get that feeling that everything's going to be all right. Everything's going to be all right. And the only other time that I can remember having that sensation, when I get up 15 minutes before the bar opened and have to march up and down in front of that door where that lady slid that slide bolt lock back. And I was out in the middle of that little town where all those people knew me, and I was embarrassed and humiliated, but I needed a drink of whiskey. And I thought the very next minute of my life might be my last if she didn't slide that door open. And finally she'd open it. An old sour smell would hit me in the face that I'd walk in there, and she'd pour me a double header of whiskey in a big tall fishbowl glass. She'd give me a beer chaser. And I'd sit there that morning in particular, I remember, and tears rolling down my cheeks. And I said to myself, everything's going to be all right now, Jim. And I didn't even have to drink it. My nerves got calmed down. And I felt like everything was going to be all right now because I was safe with my booze. And I'll take the other way of life. I'll take the getting on my knees and thanking God for the way of life of this sobriety today and the hope that I found here through you people. I thank you all for asking me up here, and I'm really grateful to have been here, and God bless you all, and I love you.